Okay, well, welcome to Nature Space with Haythes, and I'm Simon King, and today we explore the diverse and captivating world of British wildlife as seen through the eyes of our special guest, and that's specialist wildlife vet Steve Smith from Tiggywinkles, the world's busiest wildlife hospital, I'm led to believe. We're going to find out if that's correct in a few moments from Steve. They have been at the forefront of wildlife care and rehabilitation, treating over 12,000 animals annually. That's probably gone up since this was taken off the web, including hedgehogs, badgers, deer, birds, and more. So welcome to Nature Space, Steve.
Thank you for having me. Lovely to be here.
You're more than welcome. It's good to see you there. And obviously our listeners will be very interested in knowing what happens at Tiggywinkles and a little bit more about the day in the life of a wildlife vet. And I know we've just literally this. And I can tell our listeners it's been very hard to get hold of Steve, and that's not because he's been on holiday or on a cruise or anything like that. Every moment is spoken for, really, looking after wildlife. And in fact, just this very morning, actually, just previous to this podcast, Steve, you've been needed in theatre, really. So we've managed to drag you away, actually. Hopefully after you've completed what you needed to complete.
Yeah, we were doing an operation on a hedgehog, and we had an unexpected bleed, and it was not routine, and I was literally rushed in here just with minutes to spare. But rest assured, the hedgehog was fixed, and he's waking up perfectly fine, no worse for wear. He's getting some extra fluids to make up for the bit of blood he lost, but other than that, he's all good and in safe hands with the nursing team now.
Wonderful, great. That's great work. Steve, could you tell, and this is a huge question, really, but could you tell our listeners what they may need to know about you and your work as a specialist wildlife vet, please?
Yeah, sure. I can sort of try and give an insight. So in the UK, there's lots of different vets, and some vets are general practitioners, some are advanced practitioners, and some are specialists, some like registrars, consultants in human medicine, I guess. And it's a case of my career path was that I graduated in 2002. I undertook a residency, which is a specialist training position, where I had advanced training in primarily avian medicine, but also other non-domestic species, including wildlife, which led to me getting a specialist status in avian medicine and surgery, so bird medicine and surgery. So I'm one of probably three or four practicing vets in the UK that have that specialty qualification. And that also allows me to be a Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons recognized specialist in zoo and wildlife medicine. So those specialist status are achieved by lots of training and examination, and also attending various conferences and other sort of developmental processes. So what that allows really is it allows me to bring a sort of cutting edge level of experience and knowledge to the wildlife practice here. Tiggywinkles has always been at the forefront of veterinary medicine for wildlife, always pushing the boundaries, always trying to do better for British wildlife. And what I can bring to the table for the trust or for the foundation is I can provide sort of specialist veterinary care in terms of the procedures we can carry out, the medicines we can access, the techniques we use. And it really just is one part of the massive puzzle that we have put together here that allows us to provide cutting edge care for our British wild animals.
Yeah, I want to come on to the cutting edge element if we can in a while. But so rather than generalists, we're talking to a very rare and unique, I'm trying to stop myself from saying animal here, but a very rare and unique person here. We do at Haythes, we have a veterinary advisor, and he's a veterinary pathologist as well, so very knowledgeable. But I think he would say an avian vet. That's very rare. I mean, and right up our street, really. We love anything to do with avian, anything to do with birds. We're very, very, pleased to talk to people about that. Specifically when, and I suppose for you, when we talk about our diets and healthy diets, healthy birds, we'll be singing from the same hymn sheet there. So what does a day in the life of a wildlife vet look like? like. I guess they're never normal, never the same.
Yeah, no, avoiding the cliche, but no 2 days are ever the same. And that's what I do love about my chosen career. As a vet, that's often true anyway. And even in small animal practice, you know, you get different cases every day. But as a wildlife vet at a wildlife hospital that sees a lot of animals every day, every day is different. Every day presents a new challenge. Every day, pretty much, I do something new that I've not directly experienced before. And that's a massive challenge that I really enjoy. And some people don't necessarily find quite so enjoyable, sort of being slightly out of your comfort zone every single day. But for me, a typical day will be, so I'll come in normally around 9 a.m. Less of the nurses will already have started from 8 a.m. treating the animals in the hospital. So my intern and the nurses and the vet students we have will be starting the ward rounds where they treat all the patients. At any one time, we can easily have 1,000 patients in the hospital, whether that's in the building or outside. And they'll be starting treatments for those animals. They won't all be on treatment, but they all need looking at. We need to make sure they're all okay. So they'll have started treatment rounds 8 a.m. I'll come in around 9 a.m. and then sort of pick up on things that need looking at. But mostly what will happen is some point mid-morning, when rounds are starting to finish, we will then start operations. So I have a procedure list where anything the nurses have assessed that they think needs more treatment, or anything I've assessed needs more treatment, goes onto my procedures list. And that's what makes up my workload for most of the day. And that can be anywhere from usually at least 15 to 20 cases, right the way through to 60 or 70 cases in the summer in one day to be seen by me, on top of all the what's going on in the hospital. And then, yeah, we work through that list through the day. And then other things might happen. We might have to go on rescues, or we might have baby animals need feeding. And we can discuss all of those things through the podcast. But basically, it's whatever gets thrown at you. You might be prepping to start an operation, and then a deer with a broken leg will sort of burst through the door on a stretcher from a rescuer, and then you have to stop and deal with that. Or, you know, had a fox that might come in with its jaw trapped in a trap, for example. Oh. We have to drop everything and do that. So you're kind of, you try and plan your day as good as possible. And as we talked about, planning this today, and but then other things happen and you just kind of roll with the punches and deal with whatever needs to happen for the injured wild animals that come your way.
Yes. Thank as you were talking there, I was thinking, well, thank heavens really for Tiki Winkles. But this all started back in, I think, 1978. Is that right? Yeah. And why and how and where, you know, what was the thinking?
Amazing when you sort of think about it. So Les Stocker and Sue Stocker, with their son Colin, who at the time must have been, must be 10 or so. They cared a lot about wildlife, and they had I think one of their first animals they saw was an injured kestrel, and they just found it difficult to find anywhere that they could get this animal treated. You know, vets aren't necessarily set up for wildlife, or at least, you know, 40 years ago, 45 years ago, they weren't very well set up for wild animals. They didn't really always have the sort of knowledge or experience to know what to do with them. And the Stocker family found that there was just, they felt like there was nothing that could be done for this poor kestrel. So they decided to do some research and treat the animal themselves. And so they set up in their garden shed. So they literally set up in Aylesbury in their garden shed, providing first aid care. They sought the opinion of lots of different people from all over the country, and started treating this bird. And soon word spread that they were, you know, happy to treat injured wild animals. And with not many people around at the time happy to do that, they gained this reputation for looking after wildlife. So the shed grew and grew until the shed was full. And then, yeah, it was still two or three sheds in the back garden looking after wildlife. And the Stocker family were just, you know, leaders, ambassadors for wildlife in the area. And this grew and grew and grew from 1978, which, you know, literally the year I was born. And then in 1991, they managed to secure the site we're on now. So they secured it from the council with a peppercorn rents, and they fundraised to build the buildings from scratch. They fundraised widely to build the hospital that is standing now. And every year or every few years, the hospital expands and develops. You may hear drilling going on now. And as I look out my office window, they're building an extension to the ground floor to double the size of our prep area. So the Stocker family, bless him, Les Stocker passed away in 2016, but left this legacy that Colin, his son, and Sue, his wife, have carried on. I'm still involved on a daily basis. Colin's the CEO at the moment. But they left this legacy of this hospital structure that just continues to expand, continues to do what it does, to provide just care for wild animals. So it went from literally a garden shed, which is on display in the visitor center. You can see the garden shed that Les started out in with, you know, the Weetabix boxes and the things he used for first aid, right the way through to where we are now, where we're using advanced orthopedic techniques, special microplates, microscopes, and all sorts of things that we use today. So over 45 years, it's just, you couldn't have imagined it developing so well, but it's genuinely due to the determination, the motivation of the Stocker family who have set all this up. So we owe them a great deal.
Yeah. And I suppose even though it's obviously grown organically, I should imagine that they didn't realize for a moment that your services would be as required as they are today.
No, exactly. Who could have known, really? But I think with what's going on with development and housing development and networks and roads and things like that, there's increasing pressures on wildlife all the time, and it seems like now more than ever that the human effect on the wild animals is getting worse and worse. And I think probably those wild animals need us and places like us more than ever. I mean, there are lots of wildlife centers opening up around the country now. So it's really important that places do this, treat the animals, share the knowledge, share their experiences, and then we can all actually do a better job for the wild animals.
So I suppose you're seeing this, I would say conflict really, but you're seeing as we expand into territory that's been historically, you know, with natural history and nature, and we've come into conflict, ultimately possibly the victim will end up being wildlife really here. And you're patching it back up. And what happens? We'll come on to this, I'm sure, but what happens then with this? Is the objective to get them fit enough to be released back into the wild, I suppose, in most cases?
Yeah, it's I mean, you're right. You touched on it, that with increased development and houses and roads, like I mentioned, that the wild animals we have are gradually being forced out of their habitat into other areas. And there's increased education and such that developers are being more mindful of wildlife. But when you take a 5,000 home housing development, no matter what measures you put in place, there's still going to be a pressure on the biodiversity of that area. We're talking not just the animals that we see, but we're talking about the insects that feed those animals as well. So the effects are massive. There's the butterfly effect that people talk about, where affecting one population of spaces and another. So the effects of our sort of natural advancement and development in the human population definitely have an overall negative effect on the wild animal population. And you know, for that reason, I think we're seeing more and more patients at the hospital, and people are much more aware of animals in their area, much more aware of trying to provide the needs for their animals in their own gardens, but also being more aware that there are people around like us that can help those sick and injured animals when they suffer problems. And some people sort of would say, well, if a wild animal has failed the test of the wild, then maybe it should be let go in a peaceful way, or sort of people like to say put out of its misery and things like that. And there's definitely situations where we can't save them all. Sometimes they are too injured, they're suffering too much, and we have to make, you know, a decision to not prolong their suffering. But all too often, the reason these animals are suffering in the first place can be directly or indirectly related to human interaction that they would not have experienced in the wild. You know, we rarely see injuries from wild animal to wild animal interaction that would be natural injuries. And if you think about it, often those natural injuries result in death and the circle of life in the wild. So we don't see those patients. The vast majority of what we see have some link to a human problem. So hit by a car, caught by a cat, you know, displaced by a housing development, caught in a garden, caught in a trap. I had to put to sleep an animal this morning that got caught in a squirrel in a bird feeder that was so damaged that couldn't survive. So there's invariably a human element to what we do, which is why I feel strongly that we can justify helping and intervening when we can with these animals, because it's humans that have sort of led to the problem. So let us in some small way try to redress the balance here.
Yes. So that's an interesting one. So it's this, so really in these examples, an otherwise healthy animal, and as you mentioned before, I suppose a sick and poorly species of bird, you know, may be easy prey to a cat or wherever. You know, but here we're seeing otherwise healthy animals that are coming into conflict most likely with something that we humans have done, be it a car, whatever. What was the bird feeder one, as a matter of interest?
A squirrel got its legs trapped in a bird feeder, and you know, obviously there's often a garden conflict of you know, people feeding the birds, and squirrels will try to get the food out of the feeders, and you know, it's all sort of natural behavior, if you like. But I know that can be a source of irritation to a lot of garden owners that like to sort of set nice displays out for the birds to see the birds, and they get sort of attacked by squirrels. Only the other day I saw an advert for a, you know, sort of squirrel proof feeder, which was great. It relied on weight, and it meant when the squirrel was on it, it would close down so they couldn't get any food. And I think what we always have to remember is these animals are attracted by food. They don't want to steal from the feeder, but there's food that's free and available. And it's the same with foxes. People sort of sometimes don't like the fact that foxes become quite gregarious and sort of approach for food, or the red kites in our area. Some people don't like the red kites that come down and sort of swoop down for food because they're worried about the risk they present. And I think we have to remember that invariably their behaviors are influenced by our behaviors, and by sort of feeding them and attracting them or leaving lots of waste food around that is available to them, then we're going to attract these animals that are, all they're trying to do is survive. They're trying to find the next meal in order that they might survive. So I think we just have to think carefully and make sure that our behaviors and our lifestyles aren't adversely affecting the population or driving behaviors that we then don't like.
Yes. It's a very delicate balance, isn't it? Because we've taken some of the habitat, as you say, in the countryside. So they've had to venture a little bit further into a town's a garden space as we're providing food. So we've made it a little bit easier and quite rightly in many respects if we've done the damage there.
Yeah.
But obviously then we've got to do it with, we've got to make sure that we're feeding birds sensibly, sensitively. We've got to be aware of what, we hates would be very interested in knowing. I mean, obviously you're very busy there at Tiggy Winkles, but if you have information or data or feedback that says, these are the kind of things we are seeing with bird feeding activities, this kind of feeder, that kind of feeder, without us necessarily naming names, we can take a look at it. We can either feed that back, or we can just make sure that we're making our customers aware of these are the things that you need to think about when you put these things out. So we'd be a good feedback loop for that, because we put it on our website, and if there's any feeders that through the data look a little bit ominous, that maybe things are happening that we're not sure about, we'll remove them from sale. It's as simple as that.
Well, that'd be great. And it's I don't want the message to come across that stop feeding wild animals, it creates problems, because that's actually not the message. The message is just think about what we're doing, because you know, feeding the wild birds in the winter is exceedingly important. They need that extra energy to get them through the winter in a lot of cases. Supporting the local hedgehog population with some responsible feeding is a good thing to do, and we'll get on and talk about that in a little while, I'm sure. It's just the it's sort of indiscriminate or careless is maybe too harsh a word, but just people not really thinking when you have loads of rubbish left around and the bags get sort of pulled open. So, you know, make sure your food bin is nicely secured so the foxes can't get into them and sort of cause that nuisance and then get attracted in that way.
Yes,
so
yes.
I think, like I say, the message is definitely not don't feed wildlife. The message is let's think about how we're doing it and feed them in a careful, considerate, environmentally friendly, ecosystem friendly way. So actually we're doing much more harm, much more good than we will be doing harm.
We're on the same page here, Steve. I like this. And I'm glad you mentioned hedgehogs, because we get several phone calls here. One is, the squirrels are stealing all my peanuts. So that's one. So I think we'll come back to that. But the other one we get is, what's happening to my hedgehog? Now, I know that Tiggy Winkles has a very special affinity with hedgehogs. And a lot of our listeners will for Nature Space with Hayes will be very interested in hearing more about hedgehogs. We understand what some of the challenges are. There's changing landscape in our gardens, but there's lots of things we can do. Really, there are problems in terms of our education, in terms of what we can feed hedgehogs, what we shouldn't. That would be interesting, really. We know about milk, but why? What's the problem with milk? And perhaps we can look at some of the things that people might avoid, or some of the maybe when hedgehogs are presented to Tiggy Winkles, it's the not again, you know, and the things that we can avoid, things that we can watch out for. So if you can just open the door to that little world for us, that will be marvelous.
Yeah, because lots of areas to think about there. And I mean, we can start with the sort of feeding and the supportive care that you might provide. So firstly, the reason you might provide supportive care to the hedgehogs that you see in your garden is that these hedgehogs roam long distances at night. Hedgehogs can travel for up to 2 miles at night in search of food. And their natural food would be things like insects, so earthworms and beetles and caterpillars and things like that. Well, you can imagine in this sort of weather, there's not much of that around. You can also imagine, you know, when they would previously forage and roam for 2 miles, that might be 2 miles of countryside environment on the outskirts of a town, which now suddenly they find is a housing development, which is a mud pit with no fauna, no ecosystem, because it's been destroyed by a housing development, for example, or a new railway line or anything like that. So the environment's challenging, which is why certainly at this time of year we talk about providing some supplemental feed for the hedgehogs. And before I get on to the feed, the other reason that's important is because hedgehogs give birth to a second clutch in the sort of late summer, autumn time. So you suddenly got some hedgehogs appearing that are tiny, and they've got a really limited period of time to get enough body weight, enough body reserves and body fat to be able to hibernate through the winter. So when the weather gets cold, we have the frost, and they decide to hibernate, their body temperature drops, and they go into this sort of stupor state where they use their current reserves. If they're not big enough, if they're not fat enough before they go into hibernation, they won't survive. They won't come out the other end. So what we try and do is encourage people to support the hedgehog population with feeding. So feeding in a responsible way is really important. If you stick out a bowl of food, it's going to be eaten by the foxes, the badgers, the cats, you know, everything else around in the area that will probably get there first. So we need to think about providing feed in sort of enclosures. And it's hard to describe on a podcast, but if you think of like these sort of big plastic boxes, and you can cut a small doorway, maybe the size of your fist, the size of your hand.
Oh, I see.
Think of a hedgehog. We used to say size of a CD, but people don't have CDs anymore, right?
I'm old enough, slightly, only just.
Yeah, you and I are old enough, but 78. So what's a CD? Even DVDs and that now. So anyway, so the size of my sort of fist, if you like, size of an adult human's fist or a bit bigger. And then a pipe leading to that. So basically the hedgehog can sort of crawl down this pipe, get into this chamber where you just take the lid off and you feed, whereas other bigger animals can't get into there. So you're providing food for a limited population of animals, rather than feeding anything that comes along, and you can ensure the animals you're targeting will more likely get that food. So that's important to provide it in a sort of sheltered way that's not accessible to everybody. But then you sort of brought up some important points about what to feed, and people are often asking what is the best thing to feed. So you mentioned milk, and hedgehogs, unfortunately, are frequently lactose intolerant. So like with us, if they have milk, it can upset their tummies, make them feel unwell. It can give them diarrhea, and it makes them worse. It makes them not feed, makes them lose weight, and they're not going to survive well if they right. if they get fed milk. So avoiding milk is what we recommend. It's essential for their well-being. So just providing water is fine. So providing water in a nice shallow dish so that if they drink and they topple in it, they're not going to drown or have to swim or get out. If you have a deeper dish, then put some rocks in there so that if they do happen to plop in there by mistake, they can climb out nice and easily. Also remember, when it's really cold, whilst they should be hibernating, some hedgehogs that are still awake won't be able to access frozen water, so break the surface of the water for the benefit of any wild animals that might be getting to it, so they can get to the water and things like that. So water is the best thing to give, making sure it's a nice shallow dish or a dish that they can't get up to any mischief in. And then food wise it's just quite simple. There are hedgehog foods you can buy, which are really good. They normally have a high meat content, a high protein content, and there I haven't found one on the market that's inappropriate, so any of the hedgehog diets are great. But if you don't want to go to the trouble of finding a hedgehog diet, then using dog and cat kibble, so the dried food. So right. often the kitten one, because it has a smaller kibble size, and is slightly higher in protein usually. So that can be more beneficial for a hedgehog that needs that protein to put on body condition for the winter. So the puppy and kitten ones are good, but the adult ones are fine as well. They can also have the wet food as well. So the wet dog or cat or puppy or kitten food as well. And we find that we avoid the fishy flavors. They tend not to like the fishy flavors, and it can cause tummy upsets. And people, you'll read in the literature that you must not give fish flavored cat foods, for example. It tends to be the cat foods that are fish flavored. And I've never been able to find a convincing sort of absolute medical reason for it, but from our experience, they just don't like them and they get left. And like I say, I think other reports say they can cause upsets. So meaty flavored, so chicken, beef, pork, so meaty flavored dry or wet cat or dog food put out in small quantities in a sheltered enclosure with water is what we recommend. And then the final thing that people talk about things like bread. So bread doesn't really contain much nutritional value for hedgehogs, and it kind of fills them up, and then they just get a bit bloated with that. Bread and milk people like to put together, right? And that's just not good for them.
Yes.
So
why do we do it? It's us, isn't it? Bread and milk.
Yeah.
Jam as well. And
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? But it's what people do, and they mean well to do it. And what we're trying to do is just say, hey, that's great. Nice that you're thinking to do it, but instead of the bread and milk, let's do some water and some dry kibble. Much easier, much less mess, much less nasty if it doesn't get eaten. So, everyone wins really from doing that. So those are your recommendations. And for those that sort of need sort of to look at that, that information will be on our website. So if you went to tiggerwinkles.com, there's lots of different links, different things, but there's advice on there on how to support the hedgehogs in your local environment. So, or phone us, and our reception team can talk you through that. So
we'll put a link in the show notes to that page.
Oh, thank you,
Steve. Yeah. And obviously we want to get the right information out there. When it comes to bread, that just as an aside, really, Where do you stand on bread and ducks and geese and swans and all the water birds? Are we in the same space, really?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, actually. It's a tricky one that is, I guess, maybe slightly less black and white. And I like to sort of slightly edge into shades of grey with that. So firstly, it's not an optimal diet for waterfowl, let's say. But plenty of people, certainly of our generation and before and since, will have gone and fed bread to the ducks. Yeah, that's what you do, right? You go and feed bread to the ducks at the local pond, and they love it. And yeah, they seem to do well.
It's a nice way of introducing the, you know, our children, grandchildren, yeah, eventually, and so on, isn't it? Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and so they enjoy it. They seem to thrive okay on it. And interestingly, us and some other wildlife centres we work closely with, even in the hospital, will potentially feed a small amount of bread to the waterfowl, just to promote them to eat. It's often familiar for them and often something they readily take, alongside other foods such as grains, such as oats, such as pellets. So I guess what I would say is we have a large lake near us in Aylesbury, with lots and lots of ducks, and interestingly, swans and geese. And interestingly, the local shop sells duck food. So they sell these pots of duck food, which is grain and pellets. And it's a much better mix. And you rarely see bread up at Watermead, and those birds do really well and thrive really nicely. So I think my sort of take on it, I don't want to be quoted as sort of going, oh, you know, avian specialist says bread is a suitable diet for waterfowl, because it's absolutely not. But I think in small amounts occasionally, it doesn't do them much harm. But I think a better way would be to feed them a mixture of pellets and oats. And I think if you search a bit online, there's more and more waterfowl diets available that you can sort of purchase cheaply online. Mm-hmm. If you have ducks that you go and regularly feed, or swans or geese that you regularly feed.
Yes.
And maybe just making the slight switch to a better diet for these birds will be helpful.
Yes, we have he's a brilliant guy. He's a champion for his local community. We call him the River Canoe Cleaner. And he is on that front line of defense, really pulling out rubbish from our little River Freshney, which is over in Grimsby, about, you know, 20 minutes away from here or so, but it's a chalk stream. But really, you know, he's picking out loaves of bread, really, where people have turned up at the river and just, you know, almost turned, you know, put a loaf of bread into the river. So I suppose we're saying then it's all back to sensible, sensitively, you know, and so on. Little bit will not harm. It's the quantities, how it's fed. And I suppose the other thing is, you know, it's if you are feeding bread, make sure you bring your plastic. You take your plastic, the bin bag away, because I suppose, you know, from a plastic carrier perspective, you must be seeing those. We're all know about plastic carriers and microplastics and so on, the damage doing.
Yeah, definitely take your rubbish home and not the plastic, but if you're feeding and they're not taking it, they've clearly had enough. Don't keep throwing this food, right, this excess food. It's like, you know, don't discard your excess food into the river just in case someone else wants it. You just will mess up the ecosystem. But yeah, with the plastics, we definitely see plenty of problems related to plastic waste, obviously. And you know, in the profession, there's a lot of talk about the microplastics in the oceans, but also on a much simpler scale, we're seeing we see the occasional foreign body where these birds have ingested the plastic and it's got stuck in their esophagus or stuck in their stomach. But we often see plastic wrapped around limbs. So the cans, when cans are held together with the plastic, you know, most people are getting good at breaking them all now. But you know, that used to hold beer cans together and things.
The party pack stuff.
They get wrapped around legs, and things like that. We haven't seen any newer things recently, I suppose, but definitely the amount of plastic that we see associated with the wild animals trapping them things is definitely on the increase. We just have to be careful about discarding any of that material near any waterways. And that's macro plastics, that's big plastic stuff. And I'm not sure I can quantify the damage that microplastics might be doing to the wild animals, but certainly research suggests that there's a big risk there.
Exactly. I've got a couple of questions from the team as well, just popped in as well. So while they, the Haith team are over there, they're all listening as well. So, and they've just tapped a few things on my screen. So maybe we'll do a few questions and then we'll come back to some of the other stuff, really. Because I always feel like when we watch Attenborough, you know, he always leaves us with something that makes us feel that life, there's still plenty, you know, for us to feel positive about. So, but I want us to come back to that plight of wildlife if we can. But here's the questions from the team, really. So what's the most unusual patient that you've had at the hospital?
Yeah, unusual is a tricky one, isn't it? Because, unusual for me is you know, not unusual for some other people. But I suppose things that people might not expect us to see. So I think things like bats, so pipistrelle bats, so really tiny. I mean, I'm a big guy, and people have said before, you know, how does someone like you operate on something that might only weigh 4 grams? And the answer is very carefully,
yes.
And with magnification. Again, we're of a certain age where, you know, the fine focus is reducing, but I use surgical operating loops and special lights to magnify these surgical fields. So, for example, we might see a pipistrelle bat that has a broken arm, a broken radius, and I'll put a needle, so a needle that's thinner than the wire on a paperclip, so probably about half the thickness of the wire on a paperclip. We'll put a hypodermic needle in that bone to set that, and that works really well. These bats seem to frequently leave their wounds alone. So we see those, and that's pretty rewarding because that's very fine. You sort of look at that and think, well, there's nothing you can do about that. And it's yes. Like, well, actually there is. We just have to think small. And then other unusual things. We don't have so many reptiles in the UK. So when we see the odd grass snake or slow worm, that can be exciting. They will present often with injuries from gardening accidents, if you like. So you might be shrimming in your garden or digging up, and you might disturb a grass snake or some slow worms. We had a slow worm probably in the summer. We had a slow worm that had been dug up by accident during some garden renovation and had a really nasty wound to the tip of its tail. And what you might not realize is they autotomize, and autotomize means that if you've ever seen it, when a slow worm suffers an injury, it can break and it wiggles the section, it breaks off, and then it can escape the predator. So we had this big wound right by its back end, beyond where its sort of cloaca, its bum, if you like, was. My students were going, oh, how are you going to fix that? What are you going to do? What are you going to do to, you're going to anesthetize it? You're going to do all this stuff. And this is obviously not a slow worm. And I basically took the tail and I just went snap, put the tail down, and that was wiggling on the table and it was fine. And that's a normal defense mechanism. And I gave it back to the nurse, said, there you go, that's fit for release. Wow. And so it's kind of like you can do cool stuff like that. So that doesn't require me to be a specialist. That requires a bit of knowledge of the species. But
Steve, I think you're underselling yourself because this is amazing. Because I can't believe. I mean, look, we've gone from deers, we've gone from to hedgehogs, and we're now talking snakes and slow worms and bats. You know, you cannot learn all about all of that at vet school. You know, where. I mean, at least I watch 999 every now and again. It's not my favorite thing because I've got children and I don't want to watch that and be reminded what can happen. But, you know, at least if you're in that surgery, terrible things that happen, you know, at least generally it's a human being that's walking through. You have no idea, do you, really, what's coming at you next?
It's an interesting question. And you're right. So doctors have one species, one breed, in fact, you know what I mean? So they know what they're doing. Whereas, even just as a bird vet, there are more than 9,000 species of bird. Now, obviously, they're not all available in the UK, and I've not treated them all. But as an exotics vet, as a zoological medicine vet, a wildlife vet, you become comfortable with the unknown, which is really useful. You sort of the panic stations, I've never seen this before, is kind of dulled down in me. I have vet students, so I'll present a vet student with a vole. We did it last week. A vet student had this vole with an injured back leg, and I said, "Great, here's a vole, this big injured vole, back leg. What do you want to do?" And the vet student, bless her, she was great. She was really knowledgeable, but she's like, "I don't know." I'm like, why not? It's got an injured leg. Like, I don't know. It's a vole. Like, okay. If it was a cat or a dog, what would you do? Oh, well, I'd do this and this and this and this and this. I was like, okay, we have x-ray over here. We have anesthetic over here. We have surgery over here. What are those things you want to do? And then she said, oh, well, I guess we can x-ray. Great, go x-ray. And so it's just kind of you have to be adaptable.
Yes.
During all my training, we saw lots of different things. You often see lots of cases that other vets aren't comfortable seeing because it's not in their sort of species set. So you just become comfortable with the uncomfortable, if you like. And what I teach my vet students is it's about application of principles, application of skills. You can't become a really good exotics or wildlife vet until you've done some dog and cat surgery. You've done, you can do your dog castrates and your bitch spays and your normal surgeries in dogs and cats. You get your surgical techniques together. We can't, do a leg repair, a fracture repair on a squirrel or a hedgehog leg before you're good at doing general surgery. So I think all it is a case of getting some good grounding in your career as a veterinary surgeon and then using your knowledge to adapt and to apply to different species. Yes. And it's really as simple as that.
Do you have to pinch yourself sometimes when you're there and you're surrounded by, either tech or a couple of students and so on, and you look down and there's your little bat or your little squirrel with its damaged leg or your vole and think, I'm doing this. I'm here in my element by the sounds of it.
Well, yeah, it's amazing. I am really lucky to work here. So we're a big hospital. We're busy. We see lots of cases. So lots of varied caseload. I'm lucky enough to have, we developed a relationship with Nottingham University where we have an intern now that I get to train. We have two vet students here that are undergoing training on a 2-week placement. The intern's here for a year. So we have lots of people we train, but then, I remember a while ago, you may have seen it in the media, I was operating on a toad with a broken front leg. And I'm looking at this toad's broken front leg going, I can fix that. and I have 1 millimeter locking plates. So without boring your listeners to death too much.
One millimeter?
Yeah, locking. So the screws are 1 millimeter. The plate's slightly bigger. But the screws lock into the plate, which means you can put it on the bone in a sort of slightly easier fashion than a standard plate, which has to be contoured to the bone carefully. So the screws are so small that they have a piece of metal attached to the screw head that you use to screw it in. Then you snap it off when it's in, because otherwise you would just be fiddly. Yes. And it'd be too difficult. So I remember sitting there operating on this toad. And trying to get these screws in this tiny forearm. You can imagine how small that is. One of these screws, tiny forearm. And I must admit, at one point, I didn't think I'm living the dream. I'm living the nightmare. but with persistence and patience, it went really well. And we managed to put this plate on this toad, and it started using its leg fine, and we released it back to the wild. And what was interesting... Most people, were really excited and really happy. And we still had a few people that are going, well, what happens when something eats it and it eats a metal plate? And I'm like, there is a chance that some animal at some point is going to get a bit of a shock when it finds a piece of metal inside one of their prey. But it was a risk I was willing to take.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. How many patients on average do you get to treat them, really, through either weekly, monthly?
Yeah, the numbers have been gradually increasing. And the last time we sort of totted them up, we were around 14,000 a year. So that's cases that come through the door. We take phone calls about lots of other cases and things like that. So, we deal with a lot more cases than that. But actual patients through the door, around 14,000 a year. That's gradually been increasing. In the summertime, at the peak summer, we'll be seeing probably 80 to 100 cases every day. And some of those will be orphaned baby birds that don't require medical intervention. They just require feeding. But some will, you know, be injured. And then this sort of time of year, winter time, I mean, my procedure list today, this is sort of getting on for the quietest period. My procedure list today probably has about 15 to 20 patients on it for today. So busy enough. We're probably taking maybe 20 to 30 animals today, depending on what happens. Like the weather makes a difference as well. You know, nice sunny day, then we'll see more because more people are out and about. On a wet winter day like today, people aren't about so much.
I see. So there is a correlation then between grief.
COVID was really interesting. So, like everyone else, during COVID, we stayed open. We didn't close for a single day during COVID, and we were trying to be careful with our staff and sort of protecting ourselves as much as we could. It's not the sort of job you can do from home, unfortunately. So, I didn't bring all the patients home. And we found we got really busy because people were desperately out taking their, you know, 1 hour of exercise when that was one of the rules, and, you know, in their small groups. And everyone was bringing all these sick and injured wild animals to us. So the figures, our RTAs, our road traffic injuries, dropped by 75% during the lockdowns, obviously, because people went out in their cars. But our animal emissions stayed the same level because people were bringing in more injured things they were finding on their walks. But also, we saw a lot more animals being brought in that had been caught by people's cats because people were now at home where the cat brought the patient home and they managed to rescue it from their cat and bring it to us. So it's really interesting. Our numbers stayed exactly the same, but our proportion of cases really changed. So if there isn't an anthropomorphic effect to wildlife casualties, then, you know, how do you explain that?
That's a really good, that's an interesting one. And I suppose this could be really helpful at this point, because a question we do get from our customers is, you know, I've seen a baby bird, you know, during the breeding seasons and so on. And we will say, well, just give it a few moments because you'll probably see its mother will, you know, return it, or a parent will return at some point. And many do. But I suppose it's at what point, and we see it, when we watch the wildlife shows on TV, you know, you think, well, will somebody please intervene and so on? And occasionally they do, don't they? When there was that huge turtle that they had to intervene and so on and cut all the microplastics off and so on. Well, not microplastics. There was nothing micro about those plastics. I think one of them was a supermarket carrier bag. But anyway, so at what point do we intervene? What are we probably best doing? And if we have to call somebody, who do we call? So one question we are asked is, should we phone the RSPB? And so I don't want to get political, but, you know, then customers will phone us back and say, the RSPB didn't want to know. They told us to phone the RSPCA. And you think, well, okay, we'll phone the RSPB. Yes, but I give my money to the RSPB because I thought they looked after birds. And again, I don't want to get political, but I just thought perhaps you could give us a bit of a steer here. When should we intervene? Should we intervene? And if we do intervene, where do we go?
I'm definitely going to dodge the politics on that.
Let's do that.
All I'd say is all the organizations that are trying to do stuff are all doing things with the greatest of care and intent, and it doesn't always work out in all cases for everybody. So I think we'll stick with that in that
case. Let's do that.
And we do work with those organizations on a regular basis. So there's definitely, we have good relationships with all those organizations. Baby birds are a constant source of conflict for people and for us as well. Mm. And the last thing we want is a hospital full of unnecessarily orphaned baby birds. As an aside, I'll get back to the question, but as an aside, I worked out 1 year. We employ a team of feeders just to feed baby birds, and we buy food in just to feed baby birds. And I worked it out 1 year, and we spent £50,000 in a year just feeding baby birds. And that was based on the people we employ and the food we buy. Nothing to do with rent or electricity or anything like that, but just on sort of the cost of doing that. And so that gives you an indication of what we end up doing. Those are generally birds that some of them will have medical problems that need treating as well, but this is just feeding. So we have a feeder. We have feeders from 8 till 3 and then 3 till 10, and they go around. Some birds are fed literally every 15 minutes. Oh, by the time they finish, they start again and they keep going. And obviously it's baby mammals as well that need feeding. So it's a big portion of work, and all rescue centers will tell you the same thing, that yeah, what's the biggest thing that takes up their time in the summer is feeding baby animals,
right?
And we have a, and I will get back to your question, I promise.
No.
And we have a team of fosterers that will take some of the baby animals, so certainly the mammals and things, when they're a bit bigger and they don't need to be in the hospital and they're fine, we have a team of maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 volunteer fosterers that will come. They're trained in different species, and they'll come and take a group of small mammals, a group of hedgehogs, rabbits, whatever we have going at the time needs looking after. They'll take them home and they'll carefully feed them to get them to a point where they're big enough to release, and then bring them back, and then we'll get them released. So that all that sort of stuff happens. And as you say, all wildlife centers will have processes and protocols for that. But the issue with baby birds is really difficult. Obviously, birds are fledging and they're trying to leave the nest. And they're not always ready. They don't always know what they're doing, and they'll flutter down to the ground, or something will disturb them. And as you alluded to, and the advice you already give is, you know, if you see a bird on the ground, then observe it for a while, observe it for a couple of hours if it's safe to do so. As long as it's not, you know, fallen into the middle of a road, or there's a cat that's about to get it, or, you know, it's clearly in an area that's going to be at risk from predation. Then observe it, and you'll find a lot of the times the mum will be aware that bird's popped out of the nest, and they carry on feeding it. It'll only take a day or two before that bird works out that actually it can fledge and it can fly off, and it can, or it'll move back into the hedgerow, or, you know, find a safe space. Mm-hmm. So, you know, interfering as little as possible is definitely the best course of action, because if you intervene, there's always going to be risk that baby bird's not going to make it. And as ruthless as it sounds, you know, birds have clutches of several eggs for a reason. They don't aim to raise their whole clutch. They have a clutch of four or five, depending on the species, eggs, because they know two or three aren't going to make it. So, you know, it's not that we leave them and go, well, that's tough. It's just, you know, that's nature. But if we can observe them for a few hours, if they're not in danger or not in immediate danger, we can, you know, gently sort of push them back in the undergrowth, if that helps, without touching them with our hands too much, so they're not got any unnecessary smells on them. And then observe and see what happens. If there are definitely no parents around, or the parents been killed, or the nest has been abandoned, or you've got a cat or a dog that's paying too much attention, then yeah, you might have to bite the bullet and scoop that up and take it to a rescue center. But I think the key is, so there's a couple of things. Firstly, maybe phone the rescue center, your local rescue center, for advice.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain situations, certain species, certain, you know, things that we can help you with and talk to you about that might help you make a decision onto whether to leave it or not. People obviously are worried that if you leave it, something bad's going to happen, and then they feel terrible. So speaking to your local rescue center, you can find your local rescue center by going onto the internet and typing in www.helpwildlife.co.uk. So helpwildlife.co.uk. You can put it in your link as well.
We'll do that too.
Gives you a list of your local wildlife centers, the ones that are open, what species they see, and will give you contact numbers where you can ask for help, and then speak to that center and see what they recommend. And if you phone us, even if you're out of our area, we don't mind giving you some advice. Even if we're sort of too far away from you to directly help, we can always help you with that as well.
What kind of catchment, you know, do you not typically see, you know, coming to you?
Yeah, well, we're in the middle of Buckinghamshire, and we sort of go, I don't know the miles, but we go sort of north to sort of Milton Keynes, Leighton Buzzard Way, west towards Oxford, south just past the M40, maybe down to High Wycombe area, and then just to the outskirts of London, sort of Watford area.
I imagine your expertise is being called upon across the country and probably beyond.
Yeah, we definitely get calls, you know, not just from across the country. We get calls from Norway quite a lot, Germany, France, Dubai. But on a regular basis, we'll get called anywhere in the country. We've occasionally, before my time, we've done projects and help relocations as far as Scotland and things like that. So we definitely, our outreach is slightly greater than our catchment area. And sadly, our catchment areas is literally a focusing of resources. There's no benefit to bringing a sick bird casualty 2 hours in the car, in a box.
Yes.
It needs to go somewhere closer to get attention quicker.
Yeah.
You don't want a fractious deer in your boot restrained for 2 hours where you travel all the way to us. You need to get it somewhere more local. So our catchment areas in place for a couple of reasons to help people understand. One is we have a certain amount of resources and we try and use those resources on an area we think we can maintain without either becoming full or running out of resources. We're really lucky in that respect that we have lots of really good supporters and we're able to do a lot of work, but not all rescue centers have so much good support and they have to keep their areas smaller so they can do a good job for as many as they can. There's no point in doing a terrible job for too many. And then secondly, it's just like I say, logistically bringing, if we have a deer stuck in a fence at the edge of our perimeter, sending a rescuer, we have rescuers as well. So I said volunteer fosterers, we also have volunteer rescuers. So someone like yourself that, you know, has a job that may not have, you know, much to do with animals on a daily basis, you say, right, every weekend, you can call me if there's a deer stuck in a fence, a badger stuck in a shed, a fox, you know, collapsed in a garden, we'll phone you up and say, hey, hey, can you go and get this fox for us? And Simon, you'll go, oh, yeah, sure. And you'll go with your stretcher and your grasper and your cage and you'll go and find this wild animal and bring it to us so we can fix it. But so we have a finite area where we do rescues as well. Otherwise, our rescuers are traveling, you know, hundreds of miles and it's
amazing.
Just not practical.
Well done to your supporters. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yes, we have lots of people. And that's why I said earlier, there's, you know, a team behind the scenes that do all that work. And they just, I'm lucky enough because I get the animal put in front of me and then I can fix it or whatever. Whereas it's the nurses, the rescuers, the fosterers, the volunteers, the students. They're all the people behind the scenes that are doing all the great work.
Yeah, well, let's hear it for those guys. I'm not going to keep you much longer, Steve, because I know you've got a pressing afternoon as well. All of this cannot come cheap. You know that we've talked about the tech. We've talked about the obviously. You know, there's only so much the volunteers can do. How could our listeners help? I imagine you know you need some funding at some point. It'd be nice to see a little bit of money come your way in terms of Tiggy Winkles to keep you you know to keep it going. It must be a heck of a role in terms of wages and so on and that continual investment in, as you say, expansion. It's not expansion for greed, is it? It's expansion because it's been driven by the demand and nature on the back foot. So what can people do to help?
No, thank you. It's very kind. It's definitely driven. The drive from the Stocker family is literally to do the best we can. We're currently looking at investing in things like laser therapy, which increases the speed of healing and means instead of taking 2 weeks to recover, an animal might take 10 days so we can get it back to the wild quicker. A lot of the stuff you would use in normal veterinary practice that is a sort of chargeable commodity like radiography, ultrasound, we have here. And obviously, we don't charge for anything. Everything we do is free of charge. Nobody gets charged anything for what we do. You can bring an animal, leave it with us, and it gets whatever treatment it needs at the cost of the foundation. But the foundation is extremely lucky to have lots and lots of generous supporters. So ways you can help with the wild animals, and there are a number of ways. One is to go to our website, so tiggywinkles.com, and there's a donate page where you can make a donation if you're able to. Mm-hmm. But more than that, there are educational pages. You know, you help us by learning and engaging with wildlife. That helps us with non-financially, but if you're engaged and enthusiastic about wildlife and spreading the word, it improves the level of care that people give to wild animals. So our website has lots of information that you can use to learn about wildlife. But then the other thing that you can help us with, sometimes a cash donation sort of maybe seems a bit crass, but we have an Amazon wish list. So you might want to buy, you know, you might have £2 to spare, and that will buy us, you know, three pots of cotton buds that we use to toilet, you know, the next 200 baby hedgehogs, for example. So
great idea.
There's lots of stuff on our Amazon wish list, which you know, that can vary to suit your budget. There's always stuff we need there. Donations of things like newspapers and towels, pet food. You know, we can make use of lots of different things, and sometimes we have, you know, people will donate a crate of wet pet food, and that will help us feed our hedgehogs. You know, we have well over 500 hedgehogs in the hospital at the moment, and the tins of food and the bags of food they get through every day is phenomenal. So any donations and support like that is also really, really useful. So there's lots of different ways that you can help support the foundation and support us in the work that we do. And rest assured, the sort of hard work behind the scenes of the CEO, Colin, and Sue Stocker, they generate lots of support and lots of sort of engagement with the local community and the wider community. And that allows us to do things like the development that's going on at the moment is to develop a specialist college, so that we can then train local practices, train nursing groups, train members of the public on better wildlife care. So like I say, I don't want to make it sort of just about financial donations, yes, to support the work we do, which is important, but there's so, yes, many different ways that you can support the work we do at Tiggy Winkles, yeah, and we're happy to engage with anyone to help with any of those things.
Yeah, that's, we can certainly help with the sharing the information, and that's what the, you know, that's what the podcast is about today, really. There's, yeah, you know, sometimes people, you know, want to read and know these things, but it, listening to something for half an hour, 40 minutes. And what we'll do is we'll take snippets from the podcast and we'll share them so people can access information a little bit easier, you know, in segments. And also they can find the way. We'll make sure they find the way to your website as well, that Amazon wish list and things. I'm trying to fight the visual thoughts of what 500 hedgehogs look like feeding. You must have the nation's entire population of hedgehogs. I mean, my mom has one in her garden that she calls Tiny, and she waits for it every night and she feeds it every night, and I can't wait to tell her about the upturned kind of lid with the little,
yeah, you know, a few years ago people were talking about the decline in hedgehogs, and it's still declining. Mm. And we jokingly said, don't worry, they're all here. So we'll put them back in the spring. But certainly a few winters ago, we hit 1,000 hedgehogs in the hospital. So it definitely, we have a switch in the winter. So we have fewer birds at the moment, because birds make up a massive proportion of our caseload normally. But in the winter, it becomes a bit of a hedgehog hospital. And definitely you can't go around the corner without bumping into a hedgehog at the moment. So there's plenty here.
I bet. Well, look, Steve, if you don't mind, I think for me it's been everything I hoped it would be, really. Just a bit of a peek through the window, really find out more about you and your work and Tiggy Winkles as well, and the work you do. But can I leave it for you just to wrap up and just maybe share, if, you know, any thoughts, observations, anything else you'd like to say, any other tips, hints, and how you feel about what we can do to support wildlife in general, and so on. The floor's yours, if that's okay.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I think we've touched on a lot of the messages I want to deliver. But I think what I'd probably just have people think about is, in our sort of increasingly busy world, our increasing sort of need for technology and homes and development, we're always squeezing and pressurizing the wild animal populations. And we have to start thinking that, you know, I have a daughter who's 8 years old, and I start to worry that when she has children and her children have children, will we see these wild animals in urban areas? You know, will their only visualization of wild animal be, you know, on the telly or in a zoo, dare I say it? And so I think it's really important for us all to consider, you know, what we can do in our own back gardens to promote wild animal health, whether it be a wildflower garden for the insects or a hedgehog home or making holes in our fence so animals can move through, to how we can have positive impacting community projects as well. So we have these big developments to sort of keep the pressure on the developers to put wild animal ecosystem considerations at the forefront of what they're doing in that work. So whilst we fix and repair those that are going back to the wild, I think having a wider consideration for maintaining the health of the British wild animal ecosystem is really important for preserving wildlife for generations to come.
Okay, Steve, thank you. Well, thank you very much. That's a lovely way to leave the show. You've been listening to Nature Space with Hayes. I'm Simon King, and you've also been listening to our special guest, and that's Steve Smith, the specialist wildlife vet from the wonderful Tiggy Winkles. So good luck to you. Have a wonderful Christmas. If you listen to this after Christmas, well, I'm going to wish Steve Merry Christmas anyway. But we'll share all those lovely notes in the show notes. But thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Simon. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.